Welcome to Ingenious, a podcast brought to you by Engineers Without Borders at the University of Bristol. At Ingenious, we explore the future by talking with the pioneering engineers of today.
In this episode, we spoke to Dr. Flavia De Luca. I'm your host, Manus, and I'm joined by Saf and John. Flavia is a professor of structural and earthquake engineering, teaching thermodynamics and heat transfer modules at the University of Bristol. We focused on her journey into academia, international collaboration projects, and the importance of not forgetting the positive impact engineers can have on society. As always, we started by asking Flavia to introduce herself.
We're glad to have you on the podcast, Dr. Flavia De Luca. Could you please introduce yourself for our audience?
Hello, hi everybody. My name is Flavia. I am Italian, and I am currently an associate professor in structural and earthquake engineering at the University of Bristol. I did the PhD in seismic risk. I did my PhD in Italy. And after 2 years of as a postdoctoral researcher, I moved to Bristol in 2014. One of the reasons why I moved to Bristol was associated to the long-standing tradition of earthquake engineering research at the University of Bristol.
I thought first we would start by talking about your journey into the field of engineering. So could you please tell us a little about what inspired you to become an engineer and why specifically you ended up specializing in civil engineering?
Okay, this is an interesting one that has also a bit of additional information associated to the educational system in Italy. In Italy, you can do whatever secondary school and then choose whatever university thing. This is relevant in the sense that I did the classical studies in secondary school. So I was studying ancient Greek, Latin, a lot of Italian literature. But I had an intensive math course in my curriculum. Based on this intensive math, I got the opportunity to appreciate maths in general and physics. When it came to the point of choosing what to do and which university to choose, I was on the fence between maths and philosophy. And I was leaning towards maths, but from an employability point of view, I realized that engineering would have been better and would have still provided me with enough STEM material to have a deeper understanding of maths, physics, and so on, but in a more applied environment. And I also had an experience in my last year of school in which we did a math and physics competition, and all the people that were there, I was a bit out of place because I was a good math student from a classical study school, and around me there were all people coming from scientific schools, and all of them were talking about wanting to become engineer, build stuff. People were talking about building bridges and so on, trying to make better the life of people in developing countries. I found this relatively inspirational. On the other hand, there was also, I finished my my secondary school right after there was the Johannesburg Conference. The sustainability concept was put in place. It was the starting of this kind of conversation on sustainable development and sustainability very early stages. So I found this as an inspirational thing, and this is the reason why I ended up as an undergraduate in civil engineering.
Was it quite a big jump going from in sixth form, or you were mainly looking at classical studies and universities were very rigorous mathematical course? Did you find it was a big step up or very different, or how did you adjust?
It was a big step. But while at the beginning, maybe the first 2 months, I was feeling a bit the gap with respect to people that were coming from a math-oriented school. After 2 or 3 months, I was at the right pace. if I can find a comparison in the British system, there is this difference in engineering students when they start, and there are those that have done further maths as A level and those that haven't done further maths. Something that I always say to my tutees, you know, in a couple of months you will all be on the same page, so don't feel like disadvantage. Obviously, people that have done further maths at the beginning hear things they are already familiar with. But I wouldn't say that people that don't do further maths have a gap and they are perfectly equipped to do a first year in engineering. I would say I was roughly in the same place, also because I did classical studies, but because of the specialized curriculum with additional maths, I had basically the basic stuff. But indeed, there was this initial bit in which I had to push a bit more with respect to my peers.
Okay. So you've lived and worked in a number of different countries around the world. You said that something that was really inspirational for you was that attitude towards engineering, that it could be something that could improve the world. How has that attitude, how have attitudes towards academia and that future changed depending on which country you've been working in?
Oh, this is a very good one, because I can tell you, for example, I can do the comparison between UK and Italy. I think there is, when you work in academia, you have this reputational bit that allows you to work in a specific space, even a practical space, and provide, make sure that your rich background, the gift of doing a study or focusing on things, can be used by people that instead have a tighter time frame working on specific projects, delivering on specific deadline. But it would be fool to think that if you work in academia, especially if you are a lecturer, you don't have similar pressure to deliver and so on. I think possibly in Italy, there is a better perception of academics as people that can do things. My feeling is that sometimes in the UK, you need to convince industry people that academics can have a practical view on things. But this is often related to a different kind of language. So as soon as you manage to have enough interaction, for example, with the industry peers, and you manage to align your language, then you often find out that you are on the same page, you are trying to improve practical stuff, and so it becomes easy. But there is this initial issue about, you know, you are coming from academia, you are not a practical person, you don't solve real problems, you think about very theoretical stuff.
So, building on that, what was your motivation to stay in academia rather than ever, did you ever consider moving into an industry role, or why did you make the decision to stay?
Okay, I did the PhD right after I finished my master. In Italy, master are 2 years degrees. So basically, you generally, on average, you access a PhD after 5 years of study. I started to mature this idea of getting into research and possibly evaluate an academia, a career in academia, when I saw through some of the units that I was doing in the last year of my MSc that were very research oriented. There was a lot of research led teaching, and there was also a step change in the society at the time in Italy related to structural engineering. There was an earthquake, not very big, that damaged a school in, I think it was 2002, damaged a school, and there were a number of children that with their teacher that died. And these introduced a step change in the regulation for structural construction in Italy. And suddenly a lot of stuff that up to that point were just the realm of researchers in structural engineering were implemented into the code. So there was this very period in which being an academic in the field of structural engineering was something like, you know, you go out in the world and you implement things to make the world a better place, to improve the industry and so on. So I think a bit of that momentum influenced me. I have also to say that I'm not a first generation researcher in the sense that in my family there are no engineers. They are all medical doctors. But in particular, my father is now he's retired, but he's a researcher in the field of neuroscience. So in a sense, I had some feeling about, I had the privilege, because it is a privilege, of knowing a bit what entails being an academic, doing research, the fact that you can have or at least when you start, you think it is. You have a flexible schedule. You have the freedom of generally investigate things that are within your field, but you are generally interested. So, yeah, possibly. I would say these were the main factors that led me to do a PhD, in particular in seismic risk.
In sort of expanding on sort of a similar idea, you often talk about sort of the one of your inspirations to go into civil engineering is sort of it's a good mix of combining scientific research with sort of practical societal solutions. You can help humanity, you can help society with sort of practical changes. In that sense, and looking at sort of the aspect of academia research versus going into industry, do you think research is a better pathway to making society and human lives better because it sort of focuses on furthering knowledge and your interest versus industry that is more profit-driven?
Yeah, not really, because I think you can generally, it's a matter of being a human with a lot of enthusiasm and being dedicated in deepening knowledge. Whatever you do, doing it with the right level of depth, not to be superficial, not to just tick the tasks. I would say the attitude of people that can change the world is not, obviously academics maybe have a privileged opportunity for the way their work is arranged that would make them, that would put them maybe in a better position to do this kind of stuff. But in principle, I generally consider the fact that you can do new things, come up with the new applied idea that can make the life of people better, something that is not generally related to where you work, but generally related to your attitude to problem solving. And the thing that I like to think about is genuine depth. Not being superficial in knowledge. I think this is the core, trying to understand the problems in their depth. All people that end up doing good changes or impactful things that can affect many people and the lifestyle of many people are generally people that manage to go in depth.
On the note of being an academic and making an impact, I wanted to ask, when you've published research and you have these new findings, how do you effectively communicate that to industry so those sort of new findings can be implemented? And how do you ensure you're speaking to the right people who can use your research to generate a lot of change?
Okay. I think this is something on which things have changed a lot fast and very recently. Just to give you an idea, when I started my research, for example, there were academic journals that were basically the outlets where you were publishing to communicate with your peers. And then there were some specific conferences where traditionally there was a joint participation of researchers and practitioners, and possibly they were the places where there was a genuine exchange, so academic conference, regional conferences often are those that where you can do a lot of these. More recently, since the academic world has moved towards open access research, you don't need often a subscription to access journal, academic journal papers because they are all full open access. I think there has been a bit of change in the sense that still conferences possibly are the place where you showcase stuff and where industry and academia can join conferences, events, and so on. But very recently, the fact that funders that provide funding for research have imposed this thing of open access data on researchers, open access academic journals, it has made the things much more available. So even someone that is working in industry can easily access, for example, very recent academic papers on a specific topic, just making a research on Google Scholar and getting free access to research. So I think more recently things have become easier, but the principal way possibly is some specific conferences that are targeted by both industry and academia, not all of them.
I think sort of following on from that, so moving more onto the topic of sort of collaboration, I think that that sort of aspect, you sort of characterized your work even from the beginning as soon as you began your PhD and your postdoctoral research experience, you began collaborating with sort of local universities. And for example, you went to sort of the University of Cyprus for a while. How does sort of that aspect of collaboration link together with sort of academia? Because sometimes I know like people can have like the image of a person doing a PhD sitting in his room on his own and just working on his or in the lab and working on his own. So how does that sort of link together with everything?
I think the being a postgraduate researcher is a fantastic privilege because the period of the PhD is the very period in which you can generally study and focus on a topic, become the maximum worldwide expert on a specific topic, and it's a period in which during this period you can experience some loneliness just being sit in front of your laptop, reading books and so on. On the other end, research and academic research has a huge dissemination component, has a huge international dimension that goes beyond the borders of a specific country. So there is a scientific community with which you have to interact that goes well beyond whatever country you are based in. And this provides an international dimension to postgraduate research. And I would say one of the characteristics of any good PhD would be at least to showcase on an international stage your research. Now, in some cases, this can be done just through a conference because you have the privilege of having a very international environment already in your university. Or even if your university is not very international, doesn't have a hugely diverse population, you have the privilege through academic exchanges to interact with other culture, other countries. For example, I had the privilege during my PhD to be a visiting PhD student at the University of Cyprus with a researcher that at the time was moving from Stanford to Cyprus. So in a sense, I was in Cyprus. I moved from Italy to Cyprus, and I had also the opportunity to experience a way of working that was sort of imported from the US. And this is the mobility of some of the academic researcher is something that introduces a huge wealth of internationalization in academic work.
So you've got a wide variety of influences. You spoke of your father, but you've also talked about the generational history in your family and also all of your different supervisors across different universities. How do you think all of those influences have impacted your outlook? And how do you believe that you want to impact the next generation?
Okay. Let me give two kind of answers to this question. There are the practical implications. For example, I have been always thinking that if I hadn't gone to Cyprus, I would never be in Bristol today. Because just going abroad during my PhD opened up my mind a lot to the opportunity and the possibility to start to do application outside my country. Consider that I did the university in the city where I was born. That is something relatively frequent in Italy, but if you consider, this is another huge difference with respect to the UK. In the UK, generally students move, change city at least for the university. They leave their parents' place. When I was doing the university, since I had very good, the big university, and I had I was living in the third city in the country. I didn't change. I didn't move. And if I hadn't had the opportunity of the PhD of going abroad and experience this, the Bristol opportunity would have never come up. Simply because I would have never applied, and I wouldn't have known about some websites where you can find job opportunities and so on. So indeed, this is an aspect. About the second part of my response, so on a broader level, how all of this has influenced my, to use a German word, Weltanschauung, vision of the world. This is a big one, because I would say that possibly even students, MSc students with which I was working when I was a PhD, influenced my view. And one thing indeed that influenced a lot the way I have been approaching part of the research that I've been doing at the University of Bristol is possibly the fact that during my PhD in 2009, there was L'Aquila earthquake. And as a PhD student, we were volunteering to do inspections. And I went there and, you know, as a PhD student, the first thing you, as a structural engineering PhD student, the first thing you observe is, okay, you know, cracks in the column, these are shear cracks, this is this kind of thing, or this is the reason why in the code we do this. But you also look at houses that have been left in 2 or 3 minutes. So, you know, you walk around places that are damaged, and there are different personal things of the people that are in the houses. You meet people that see you taking the inspection, and they are, for example, working, not living anymore in their house, but they are close to there in a sort of temporary shelter. And they talk to you and they ask you, oh, you are an engineer, what do you think? And you genuinely realize that there can be a human impact on what you do, and also you also realize how to a certain extent your interest about the difference between a shear crack and a flexural crack is very important, but there is a lot beyond that about the how you can impact the life of people. So I would say that this experience, not only from the technical point of view, but from the human point of view, the idea going into a place that was struck by an earthquake very close to the time in which it happened, has affected a lot the way I approach today research. So there are a lot of influences. All the people you meet in your everyday life will have an impact on your way of looking at world, doing your things, being a professional on your own. But possibly this was one of the things that changed a lot my view of things and the motivation about trying to make an impact in the world through my research.
On that note, when you're mentioning how, you know, being an earthquake engineer, you can make an impact on a very human level. Is that something else you try to sort of replicate with other areas of your work? Because I know you're currently with the, you work a lot with international development. There's a project, I think, mm-hmm. working on in collaboration with the University of Malawi, another one in Nepal. You work with the Bristol Poverty Institute as well. So is that sort of idea of really having a personal and human impact of very importance to you in your career in general right now?
I see this, the work I have been doing more recently on international development was a sort of a way that made me close the loop with respect to what I was thinking about sustainable development when I signed up to become an undergraduate student in civil engineering. Because if I go back to my, for example, PhD research, was the kind of scientific impact I tried to make at the time. It was generally related to structural model, nonlinear analysis, even in engineering seismology aspects about how to select the ground motions for nonlinear dynamic analysis. But there wasn't this dimension of international development. This is an opportunity that I got when I moved to the UK, and it was related to the fact that in 2017, there was this Global Challenge Research Fund. So suddenly a number of opportunities to do research in the Global South came up. And as a research group at the University of Bristol with the long-standing tradition of earthquake engineering, the fact that we have a very advanced lab, we ended up winning awarding a number of projects in Nepal for on seismic resilience of school in Nepal and seismic risk assessment in Malawi. And obviously this became an opportunity, a huge opportunity to close a bit the loop and add a dimension, an additional dimension to the research beyond the technical aspects. And one of the things was also the fact that at the time, the call itself for funding was asking us to provide an interdisciplinary dimension and include, if possible, a social science dimension in our research. So all these projects had a community engagement component, social science dimension. And even if I was not directly the responsible for those aspects, being part of a team that was doing this kind of stuff and was also looking at the interdisciplinarity dimension, I think it improved my understanding of specific issues, my understanding of how you deliver and you transfer or you co-produce knowledge in the Global South. And I think it was a hugely formative experience that I now bring forward also in my current research experience, because the point of co-production is not only associated to something that you do with the international into the international development space. Maybe it's something that there is a big thing, but this co-production thing of research, of results and so on, is something that you need to apply also when you work with the industry. Exactly because of the thing that we were discussing earlier about finding a common language. So this point of a co-production that I learned into the space of international development, doing work in Nepal and Malawi, that was, I have to say, fantastic, is also something that has changed me in my interaction for my research, for example, currently in the UK, I would say. So it's something that now expands in all the spaces, even in my teaching practice, I would say, when I try to interact with the students in a constructive way to address things in a co-production, with the co-production principle, let's say.
And in terms of, you mentioned that collaboration with the Global South, do you think it should be more prevalent where institutions in developed countries should be prioritizing using their expertise to help institutions and communities in developing countries? Do you think that should be something that's more widespread than it currently is?
You mean basically having a limited amount of funds? Let me see if I understood the question. Having a limited amount of funding, how do you deploy them and which countries you select, those where, for example, government institutions are more keen to introduce or co-produce knowledge with respect to other. Is this the request or more about...
That's part of the question, but also, do you think that as a researcher in a developing country, you can make a lot more impact perhaps in a... You're in a developed country, sorry, and maybe there's that much larger knowledge gap within a developing country. Do you think more researchers should be dedicating their time to be trying to solve problems in developing communities?
Okay, I see your question. This is an interesting one because, for example, one thing that happened when we started to work in Nepal in particular, because this was the first project with which I worked, the SAFER project, with Professor Sextos as PI. Basically, at the beginning, we were finding that interacting with the local universities, especially local industry, local stakeholders, they often wanted from us sort of consultancy work rather than research work. So as a researcher, we were approaching the problem, okay, we want to do something new and original that can improve things. Let's do it together. Sometimes what was needed in the field was, you know, we don't really need this original stuff. We just need a bit of consultancy to understand how we can implement some stuff that are done somewhere else at a good level, how we can implement them. And finding this fine balance between consultancy work and research was a very delicate aspect that we always try to get right. And in a sense, this is correlated to your question about which kind of research we should do. Where do we invest our money? Do we do research in the UK to advance the situation of developed countries? Or do we invest more in research on how to improve things in the Global South? A bit of a balance would be important, and it is important to keep the flow of some research streams, considering that, for example, in the UK there is a lot of expertise in general on this. But at the same time, I always think that there are some research aspects of research that is funded for the UK and for, let's say, developed countries that can be adapted, used, or adjusted for the context of developing countries. So I don't see this huge barrier. Indeed, there is a point of spreading geographically funding, giving the opportunity to cover different topics, not being only focused on the very things that are only very close to you. So, okay, I have to work with the industries that are 1 mile away from my university. Indeed, it's an important thing because it's associated to the mission of the university within a community, but at the same time, I think this keeping the international dimension, spreading geographically the interest, and adjusting research to different targets is something that should be done. So to reply to your question, you know, a bit of balance would be it's the right thing to do, not necessarily thinking that what you do for the UK or for the developed world cannot be at all adjusted or adapted for the Global South.
I think the sort of aspect of the connection between engineering and sort of changing society for the better, I think that's a very important thing that you've talked about, and that sometimes we who are students who are studying engineering sometimes forget in the midst of all of doing all of the maths and the partial differential equations, you sort of forget that really what's important is trying to help other people. And I think that's a really important message. And do you think that university should be doing a little more to sort of push that and give that sort of context to students who might sometimes like get swamped in all of the studies and forget to see that sort of aspect?
Okay, on this I'm going to provide a very disruptive response because I have a sort of strong opinion on
this. We love disruptive response.
I was just mentioning something at the beginning about depth. So while I think we could do more in our curricula, I also think that we could do more when our students have enough information to receive this more. So while I can see the benefit of doing a number of initiatives, for example, where if we think to the cycle of an undergraduate student in third or fourth year, I generally think that you need to know your differential equations and your maths to appreciate and give enough depth to the things that you're doing, because otherwise it becomes a lot of words, a lot of nice intentions, very well-intentioned stuff that in the end don't end up in factual results, because you don't have the tools to understand things, to be well equipped. So indeed we can do more, but I think there is a lot of work around making sure that we ground truth a bit the things that you try to do. But we shouldn't forget the fundamentals. So inevitably, the first and possibly the second year of formation of an engineering student has to deal and confront with some fundamental aspects of science that are needed. Because otherwise, that depth I was talking about earlier, that is one of the necessary aspects that allow you to make a change, not only talking about the change, won't emerge. So yes, but with a pinch of salt in terms of timing this kind of broader exposing students to broader interest.
So it's sort of a compromise that you need to reach, and it's sort of slightly tricky because
we are all exposed to a huge amount of stimuli from the external world. A lot of things are happening. You would like to be everywhere to understand a lot of things, TV, podcast, a lot of things that are stimulating us. But we also need to make sure that our students have enough time to think about stuff, about the stuff they need to become skilled engineers. So, balancing the two things and finding a compromise is important, because otherwise you overcrowd the curriculum with a huge amount of offering that this can distract a bit from the real fundamentals that are what will make the backbone of your knowledge to be a changer later.
So on that note, with your experience, especially pertaining to your experience of the education system in other countries and other organizational structures, and including all of those external influences we discussed, what's one thing that you'd change about this university?
Okay. I have been experiencing, as at undergraduate level, let's say a master level, the Italian system. So I never experienced the UK system as a student. This is an important premise because obviously, in a sense, it acknowledges the bias in the response that I am going to give. Conscious and unconscious, all the biases that are embedded in this response. I think that moved to the UK, I found that the component of a practical work that is embedded in the UK system and a strong connection with the industry was something amazing that was generally an added value. With respect, for example, to the experience I had, I needed to become a PhD student to start to understand Sun Dynamics. I can see that our students managed to get this experience from the beginning. So they start to have a bit of awareness of the outside world from early stages, and this is a positive one. Possibly exactly related to the question earlier. Sometimes I also think that we bombard our students with a huge amount of opportunities, things to engage with, and unless you are very considerate as a student, and you realize, okay, I can be a student and decide to do one or two things because I want to do them well. There is the risk that people try to be everywhere, to do a lot of things at the expense of depth. So possibly a bit of additional guidance on the point, on this very point about depth. The value that you can add deepening things. But without, for example, the background I had and the study I did, sometimes I have been studying in my undergraduate a lot of things that possibly came across in my experience, maybe one or twice, and you think, come on, you have been spending 2 weeks, a lot of headaches, a lot of, stress before exams to solve very specific problems that then came up in your professional career once or twice. So on one end, I think there was too much in that system on this. On the other end, the awareness of the existence of such complexity already available in the knowledge is something that we need to keep in our curricula. Because it's true that as an engineer in 2023, you can go on the internet and find at least the references or the solution and then find an open access paper that will provide you with the necessary knowledge. But at least you need to know the existence of some aspects. So maybe selection of offering in the curricula or making sure that our students then in a considerate way select different things without them feeling the necessity of being everywhere, doing everything at the perfect level. You know, time is limited, so you need to make a selection. So possibly this is about narrative and messaging, not something that I would change structurally. And some additional hints in some points of lectures, just to open a window on some more complex aspects that don't need to be deepened in the sometimes boring way that I was forced to do as a student in Italy, but at least the knowledge, so that in those one or two situations where I had the privilege of saying, oh, you know what, when I was in my undergraduate, we did that, I think I know which kind of book or reference we should use here and so on, possibly something similar but at a more superficial level, not going into depth. So informing students and giving them the landscape overview of some advanced things that are available, even if you don't have the time to squeeze them in a curriculum.
So a lot of students, when things are very briefly mentioned and thrown out there, are very obsessed with the manner in which that content will be assessed.
Oh,
how
yeah.
do you think that we could alter the assessment format to benefit that that method of learning?
Okay, so on this, for example, this is my personal technique. I try to do a bit of this practice of opening sometime a window on the landscape of some advanced knowledge that is a bit beyond the scope of the very unit. But I am always very clear with either capital letter optional or making sure that I clarify that very topic discussion is not necessary for the intended learning outcome and what will be assessed. And I think being transparent on this, it's important because it's very understandable that if a student wants to get a good result on an exam, but that very exam is not, or that very topic is not their favorite one, they are perfectly entitled to ignore my optional additional pages, and they should rightfully do this with the necessary knowledge without being forced to do that. So I think with the improved assessment practices, I think transparency and awareness are always the good word to have a good relationship with the students about how they will be assessed and so on. But I think also the assessment point is important. As a student, for example, the assessment is also something that sometimes forces you to do stuff that at that very moment you don't think they are important. And you find out that they are important later. So I think there is also this educational component of making sure that people make the most out of their time at the university, because otherwise that time will go and they will not have obtained the opportunity of getting through those ILO. So I think the importance of keeping the assessment, making sure that there is a moment in which you say, okay, in this class, there are people that have found some interest into this and have achieved these ILOs, and there are people instead that have generally enjoyed and had an excellent result into this. Also because this is a guidance for the future, because when you do a degree, you don't... there are huge and multiple route that you can take after. So knowing the things where you are good, knowing the things where you are excellent, it's generally important because they can help project your choices. So, but I think, as I said, transparency and awareness possibly are the important things to make sure that there is a physiological and positive dialogue between student and staff in discussing assessment, feedback, and the different components of teaching.
Perhaps continuing with the topic of sort of teaching, how do you think that as a professor, sort of the balance between teaching and research plays into sort of your work?
Okay. This is a tough one, especially after a global pandemic, because
How was teaching in the pandemic?
Very stressful. Very, very stressful. But because there is always this tension between teaching and research in terms of time management. And there is also this subtle thing that research, being something also associated to your inherent passion, as sometimes expands a bit into some of your personal time. So you would justify yourself when you do the unhealthy thing of saying, okay, I will think about this research stuff tonight, when in principle you shouldn't, you would not be supposed to work. But you generally enjoy and you recognize the added value of this, so in a sense you do it, while the teaching thing is a thing that you have to do, because you have to go to the class, you have to deliver the lecture, you have to make sure that the material is available within a certain time frame. You have to make sure, basically, for that point of transparency and dialogue, you need to keep the right standard, because otherwise, With what face you can ask some certain standards to students if you don't try to keep those standards yourself? So it's indeed a challenging one. But possibly the pandemic has, since the very practice of the delivery has changed, we had a huge learning curve. I can remember this thing of recording videos. And the first time, for example, I had a huge issue about subtitles. Because I have, as you can hear, a very Italian accent. And all the subtitles tools were not getting my my way of speaking. So in the first, I had spent days and nights just retyping things in subtitles, correcting all the words that were completely wrong. Then with time, I learned how to improve the transcription, basically the trick, just for everyone that is listening, that has a very strange accent, talk slowly. This is the rule. And generally the software, possibly the software have also improved. I don't know. Maybe, yeah. You know, with a bit of machine learning and things like that, I think things have improved as well. But indeed also the embarrassment of not having in front of you people, students, not having the chance of checking the faces, dealing with these icons, with the faces, with no camera, and saying, okay, are they sleeping behind this camera? Or there is a component of human interaction when you do a lecture that I think is a very important component that was lost at that time. On the top of the point of recording videos, that was very, very challenging. Seeing your face, trying to transfer some stuff that you typically do during an in-person lectures with the tools and so on. But there has been a huge amount of learning. So I think that we are now in the phase where we can generally get a lot of advantages out of this traumatic learning experience we have been all doing during the pandemic.
Yeah, I think perhaps backtracking slightly, in the recent years, you worked with researchers and universities all over the world, from Japan to Nepal, Africa, the Americas, almost every continent. I'm sure Antarctica is on the to-do list. But what do you think is the most difficult thing about sort of collaboration with sort of such faraway countries like Japan? And what is the most enjoyable thing?
I think the point of a common language that I was making earlier in the interaction, related to the interaction between industry and academia, is something that you need also to use and adapt when you work with researchers from different countries. It's a challenge, but academics have... I think the trick is to push on the points that you have in common. So an academic from Nepal, from Malawi, from Japan, UK or Italy, being academics, they have basically some aspects in common. These are those that that you can exploit at the beginning to start that language and the conversation and make sure that you have a transparent and good communication. Then once the relationship is set up, you can face the aspect of different way of working, different approaches to deadlines, different approaches to, organization of work. But again, similarly to the point I was making with respect to interaction with the students and teaching, I think being direct and a bit transparent is often the key. Sometimes, at the beginning, you can be perceived as a bit even brutal sometimes, but it's a good way to set up a playing field, clarify what are the expectations, is basically the key that will make collaboration working nicely, and also adding a bit of understanding, because you know, regardless of all the big projects and the things, you know, people have life, things happen, things are happening, they can delay plans, and so yeah.
Do you mind if I drag the topic of conversation almost entirely new topic, just because I think we can't have a conversation with Flavia without talking about earthquake engineering in a bit more detail, and in terms of and also looking at earthquake engineering in within the context of international development, especially considering what's happened recently in the news in Turkey, and so I think it's quite important. But I wanted to ask, firstly, when looking at countries that are prone to earthquakes, most of them are in developing countries. I want to know your opinion. How can those developing countries adapt to earthquakes when funding is limited?
Okay. I fundamentally disagree with the point that most of them are in developing countries. The thing is that you hear about them because earthquakes have a disruptive effect in places where there are less funding to be prepared to earthquakes. So it's true that earthquakes striking developing countries are louder in the media, but this is because earthquake-prone countries that have more funding in general manage to contain losses in a more efficient way. So just an example, if you think about California and the US, or you think about New Zealand, obviously these are countries where the culture of preparedness and investment in earthquake engineering have improved, and up to a certain level limited the impact of events. Not always, because I will provide you later with an example, with a counter example with respect to the typical association of earthquake prone country, huge losses associated to events. But indeed, what you say is true. When in a country there aren't enough resources, it's very likely that an event that has a return period, like significant earthquakes that can have significant losses, that is between 30, 50, 100 years, get forgotten and are not in the priority list for this very restricted funding. One example is, for example, the thing that we noticed when we were in Nepal. When, for example, my colleagues were interviewing school communities, they were doing a categorization of different natural hazards, and earthquake was at the bottom. Earthquake was at the bottom in most cases because, for example, flooding events recur yearly, in some other countries there is the issue of famine, disease. So obviously there are pressing things that don't make earthquake preparedness be prioritized. On the other hand, when a huge earthquake happens, like the one in Turkey, it's such a disruptive event with such huge consequences and longer term consequences that you start to realize, and people in different governments start to realize, how important it is to put in place a preparedness measure. Just to make an example, for example, obviously in the recent Turkey-Syria event, given the magnitude and the area that was interested, the effects were huge, and there are a number of victims that have made this event a humanitarian catastrophe. But for example, in that very area, hospitals were all base isolated, so they remained, most of them remained functional because there was the awareness that strategic building need to remain functional. In the context of such a distraction, obviously this is not something that has been a game changer for this kind of event, but it's indeed something that we should consider. And also the size of the event that we have seen, for example, in Turkey, was so significant that you know, even a developing country possibly would have faced significant losses, but not as significant as in that case. Simple example: 2011 earthquake and tsunami in Japan. You know, we would have thought that nuclear power plants were safe. We were in Japan. In Japan, they know that there are earthquakes. They are very well equipped with that. And instead, there was an event for which basically the level of preparation was not enough. So on this very aspect, I would challenge a bit the narrative: developing country, global south, earthquakes can produce a huge effect. Indeed, the kind of losses and how the losses are deaggregated in terms of human toll, economic losses, secondary losses, supply chain losses is different. But I think that there is still a lot of work to do. That's why I think that the research we do as earthquake engineers is still very important. It's not like that we have found all the responses or all the solutions to the point of being prepared to future earthquakes.
I think that was quite an eye-opening thing where... You're right, in the media you only ever really hear about earthquakes when they're catastrophic, and they tend to be catastrophic when they're in developing countries. It's quite a bad correlation I made in my mind about linking developing countries to earthquakes. But what sort of measures can be put in place in developing countries to help mitigate earthquake risk, especially when they have limited money to invest, and also when perhaps most of the buildings and infrastructure already in place isn't safe in the first place? So what would you suggest? Let's say if you were advising the Turkish government now or the Syrian government, okay, what would you be saying to them?
Let's say that this is a bit beyond my paycheck, but I can provide a general advice on that. Indeed, for example, when we have been working in developing countries, and even if you go into the literature, there is a lot of adjustment that you can do to very innovative techniques to make them more cost effective using local materials. For example, my colleagues in the earthquake engineering group at the University of Bristol have been working recently on a low cost base isolation technique that was implemented for a school in Nepal. So there are possibly one of the things is to adapt some approaches to optimize costs. There is also another important aspect. For example, during the work we did in Nepal, working with a postdoctoral researcher that currently is now in the reinsurance industry for catastrophe modeling and things like that, we work together on different financial model for retrofitting, so phased retrofitting to make affordable the retrofitting and convenient retrofitting in particular. We worked on Nepal, and we were working on the fact that, for example, during the reconstruction after the 2015 earthquake, a lot of people didn't want to repair their houses because they had a bit of mistrust in the idea of retrofitting, and so they wanted basically to rebuilt, but the money available were not enough to rebuild, so they were building smaller houses and so on. So what we tried to do was to address these, suggesting phased retrofitting that would achieve a good compromise. But just to come back on the very point of prevention and good practice, obviously code enforcement is something that is important, and is important everywhere, not only in developing in the Global South or developing countries. The issue of code enforcement is a bit everywhere, and also dealing with existing buildings. So try to make sure that you can improve the safety, the earthquake safety of existing building. Also, this has an impact from a carbon footprint point of view. So indeed, there is a lot that can be done, but the easy bits are indeed the code enforcement. If you think about the code that they have in Turkey, this is a very up-to-date building code. It's not hugely dissimilar with respect to the prescriptions that you have in Eurocode. The problem is that when you go in remote areas, it's very challenging to do the code enforcement. So there is also the aspect of cultural change, code enforcement in a broad sense, not only policing, but also trying to improve things in a way that there can be a cultural change.
Okay, I think we should start wrapping things up. I think we've covered a lot of topics that have been very important from sort of our role as engineers to more specifically structural and civil engineering. And I thought maybe to finish off with, what is something that you want to work on which you haven't had an opportunity to work on within sort of the domain of earthquake, civil, structural, geotechnical engineering?
Okay. This is a very personal one in the sense that I have been trained as a structural engineer, and I have been working in the space also of engineering seismology. For example, this is something that we do a lot with some M-level units here at the university. And I have been doing a lot of structural reliability, so application of probability and statistics to structural engineering and engineering seismology. The bit on which I have started to work, and I would generally would like to have the time to deepen a lot, is to specialize on the interface between structures and geotechnics, so push the frontier on soil structure interaction. This is something that I have started to do. It's not new to me, but it's a topic on which there is also a lot of additional knowledge. So there is a lot of professional and personal development that I need to achieve to get that level of depth that I would like to achieve to do good level of research in that very field. And I would say one of the reasons is also that we have a unique and once-in-a-lifetime opportunity as an earthquake engineering group and structures and geotechnical team at the University of Bristol.
Because there has been a new facility.
Yeah, basically, we have a new lab that was funded by EPSRC, whose focus is on soil structure interaction. It's not only based on soil structure interaction, because the very lab will have the opportunity for us to be employed in different things, even interdisciplinary. But indeed, the privilege of having a nice, huge pit where you can do research on soil structure interaction, on bridges, offshore wind turbines, and so on, opens up a huge field of experimental research. So possibly SSI, so soil structure interaction, and large-scale experimental research. It's a topic on which I would like to push the boundaries.
Thank you. That was great. Thank you for coming onto our podcast.
Thank you so much.
If you enjoyed this week's episode of Ingenious, please subscribe and share the podcast with friends. We'd also love to hear your feedback. To get in touch or find out more about us and our guests, head to ingeniouspod.org. Music for our episodes is kindly provided by Yemzo Katana. Check him out on SoundCloud.